The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And I think we're okay now, Doug. My volume meters on one of my streaming sites were not picking up, but I think they're okay now. Listeners, okay. If you're having trouble hearing on either of the streaming sites, please let me know. I may need to change volume settings. I don't know how they got changed, but the view meters don't look like they normally look. So just email me if you're having a problem, and I'll go make that change real quick. Welcome to a special edition of the Monday Space Show. Rather than being in the afternoon, we're doing this in the evening at 7 p.m., and our guest again is Doug Messier. You can call and talk to Doug, 1-866-687-7223. And no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll answer it and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. A couple of announcements. Do visit our website, thespaceshow.com, so our detailed, fresh website newsletter with all the information, coming attractions, coming guests, and everything that you need to know about how to listen to the streaming shows. It's all there, updated as of last evening, and you'll see it in the middle of our website. You can't really miss it. Everything we do is archived, and it's on our website. You can easily listen right off of the website, or you can download the shows. There's a store up in the upper left-hand corner. You'll see it. It's called Space Show Gear. Please visit it. Hopefully, you'll find some items that are interested in, or that you're interested in. I buy a lot of baby clothes there that say Space Show on it. I have a lot of friends and listeners that are having children, and I give them something that's space-related, and Space Show bibs and clothing are pretty cool. They seem to like that. There's also the Support the Space Show button there. So remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're able to bring you all of these programs because many of you do financially support and donate to the Space Show, and we're deeply appreciative of that. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction, same as if you're a California taxpayer as well. If you have any questions or comments, please let me hear from you or visit onegiantleapfoundation.org. Please remember, we're trademarked and copyrighted, but all of you have permission to download our shows, share them, pass them around on the internet. There are hardly any restrictions. Simply don't do anything commercial with the shows. No edits for your own website or a YouTube channel or anything of that nature, and no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. Podcasting goes through gigadial.net and Andrew, and if you want the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast, it's on our website, both of our newsletters. If you have any podcasting questions, don't hesitate to send me an email. Do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security, and you'll get much more information about them if you visit their website, www.swfound.org. They do sponsor our webinar series, and remember, I've been telling you we have one coming up for the mitigation of disaster problems on Earth using space resources. That was planned for July 6th, but one of the participants has had to do a different thing with her schedule. So we're going to have to delay that, and we're working on a new schedule. So July 6th is actually part of the July 4th holiday weekend, so we will not have a show that day. We're not going to do a show on July 4th or Sunday, July 6th. So that Secure World Foundation webinar, as soon as we get it rescheduled, we will certainly share that information with you. So our guest today is returning guest Doug Messier, and he has one of the best ever news, space news blogs, Parabolic Arc, one word, .com. And this updates with all sorts of space news information, not just new space, but the traditional aerospace industry, foreign news, all sorts of things. If you're not making it one of your daily stops for news and events and information, I think you're making a big mistake. Doug Messier is the managing editor there. Not only does he cover commercial space, he also covers government space and just about every form of space here and around the world that you can imagine. Doug is a very skilled writer and an analyst. He's got over two decades of experience in covering space exploration and scientific policy and issues. He has held a number of positions as an analyst at a Fortune 500 company, software tester for a startup company, manager of a distance education at a small for-profit university, science editor, curriculum developer. He is a biographer of a Mormon missionary, a script writer, and he has pitched stories to Star Trek. He is author of Carl, the biography of William Carl Condy, a 220-page privately published biography of a beloved grandfather. He lives in Mojave, California, where the action is for suborbital and the new space industry. He's also writing the coolest book ever on X-Corps, which we hope we get to read soon and have Doug on the show to talk about. He serves as Director of Testing, Communications, and Social Outreach for an entrepreneurial software company. He went to ISU Summer Session Program and GWU in Washington, D.C., where he studied under John Logsdon at the Space Policy Institute. He also has his undergraduate degree in journalism. It's always an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, Doug, and welcome you back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me back. Fun to talk with you.
Let me start out and ask you a couple of questions about news events, what's going on in Mojave since the last time we talked to you. It is a hotbed of new space and commercial space activity. Is that stable? Is it threatened by Governor Perry coming here to recruit, you know, companies to go to Texas? We always see in the news Governor Perry of Texas is coming to California, and he's wooing a lot of the new space businesses and all of that. So is Mojave stable? Is it growing in terms of space activity? Overall, how do you see that?
Well, all of the above, probably. X-Corps, as you know, about 2 years ago decided it would move to Midland, Texas, move its R&D facility there. It'll still maintain some activity here in terms of flight testing, or at least flight operations. And they're waiting for Midland to get a spaceport license, which looks like they will do that by no later than mid-September. So they're taking off once they hit some initial flights of the Lynx, and hopefully later this year. But overall, the airport's been growing. I mean, Stratolaunch is located here. There's been some new companies that have come in on the aviation side. So it's fairly stable, but it's also they worry about other governors from other states trying to come out here and work full way. So, it's threatened. It's growing, but it's also threatened. So it's kind of a mixed bag out here.
Is it easy for you to cover and get information on Stratolaunch? They're pretty tight to the chest, and I actually agree with that policy. I've always said on the air I agree with Bezos' policy with Blue, although I'd give anything to interview Bezos or to talk to anyone from the company. How much information can you get on Stratolaunch?
Very little. I mean, I know some people over there, and they don't tell me anything really, other than they're very busy and they seem very happy. You know, things are moving along, and they're looking at they're going to roll out the aircraft well before they get the rocket done. So there's orbital scientists and ATK are working on the rocket. And basically, Stratolaunch is mostly scale composites. So, and I think EAE Systems is also working on it, and we've got Dynetics in Huntsville.
Is any of it visible when you're out at Mojave, or is it all under, you know, covered buildings and hangars?
It's mostly under covered buildings, but between the two buildings, there's a large production hangar and then a production facility and then a large hangar for the eventual aircraft. And usually you can go out and see what look like molds for wings and stuff in between the buildings. So that's interesting. I took a visitor last week who was in town around the airport, and there wasn't much to show him because everything's in buildings. So you can go see the Stargazer, which is Orbital Sciences, L-1011 that they use for launching the Pegasus. But mostly you can't see what's actually going on inside the buildings. So.
When you mentioned X-Corps in Texas, so clarify this. Is X-Corps planning a 100% departure from Mojave in California for Texas, or are headquarters staying here, the top people like Jeff and others staying here, or will they ultimately be relocating to Texas too?
They're moving their R&D facility to Texas, which is most of the company. I think they want to be able to fly the Lynx out of Mojave. So when Lynx flights start going, I think on a commercial basis, my understanding, I could be wrong, but I think they would be flying out of, they'd be testing out of Midland and maybe flying some flights of the Lynx out of Mojave. So Jeff Grayson and the top guys are all going to Midland.
I've got an email question from you from Jerry in San Diego, and he says, I heard you last week on the Hotel Mars segment David does with the John Batchelor Show. Shortly after that segment, I started seeing news articles appear that Virgin has a new fuel. I know you mentioned that on Batchelor, but he doesn't really give anyone time to elaborate on anything. Can you tell us more about the new fuel? Does this mean they've replaced the engine, and if they've replaced the engine, did they have to remodel Spaceship 2 or White Knight 2?
Those are really good questions. Basically, what happened is that they had this nitrous oxide and rubber motor, which they've been working on for a very long time, and they did 3 flights with that engine. Now, the problem with that engine is that it was basically blowing chunks. Rubber were coming out, and there were issues with vibrations and oscillations. So they couldn't get that engine beyond 20 seconds. So they flew 3 times versus 16 seconds. Every 2 or 20 seconds. Now, the Sierra Nevada Corporation, which has been developing that engine, thought they had a solution in December. So they did this test down in Poway with POWOC, which is their testing facility in Southern California. And they added a whole lot of helium to the burn. So Virgin Galactic was pretty excited about this. And they released a video of that burn, which went for about 5 seconds, and declared that the burn was full duration and would get the vehicle into space. Now, the problem with that, and so they decided to go forward at the beginning of the year with modifying Spaceship 2 to put helium tanks in the wings. So if you put helium tanks in the wings, they also thought about putting a helium tank at the back of the cabin. And they realized that putting a helium tank at the back of the cabin without a bulkhead would have been a really bad idea. So they modified the ship for that. The helium tanks in the wings are going to stabilize the burn. And now there are a couple problems with that. One is that it would reduce the number of passengers to 4. The second was that it probably couldn't get to 62 miles, which is the official international boundary of space. It might get to 50 miles for people in the back. So that was a bit of an issue. And I did a story, and I co-wrote a story in the London Sunday Times talking about cracks in the wings of White Knight 2 that they discovered after Virgin had taken over possession of that ship, the mothership. And it also included in that story was the fact that they couldn't get to 62 miles, might have trouble getting to 50. So a couple weeks later, they announced a change. At the end of May, they announced a change in the engine. So they would go with this alternative engine that Scale Composites was developing, basically a form of plastic. I've been calling it nylon. That's what I've heard it is. So it burns smoother and doesn't have the oscillation problems. Could probably get the ship higher. But there's a bit of a change in that, in the sense that they need to inject methane at the start of the burn to make sure it burns hot and that you don't get a hard start. So they're firing them. They're injecting the methane with the nitrous oxide to get it started, and that'll come from one of the tanks, and then the other wing tank will have helium in it, which they'll inject at the end of the burn to stabilize the burnout. So that's what they announced at the right before Memorial Day. It was a Friday before the long Memorial Day weekend. They announced it in. Alan Boyle had the story. Now NBC Universal has a deal to chronicle the Branson's eventual flight into space. They announced that on the beginning of a long weekend when nobody was paying attention, and apparently had not informed SNC about it. So the folks at Sierra Nevada Corporation were completely shocked that this change occurred. And they were told they were going to be involved in the continued involvement in the engine program, but they all thought that the program had been totally canceled. They might be out of jobs. And so it was kind of a complete surprise to them, and it really surprised a lot of other people who knew what was going on, that they'd made a change suddenly in the engine.
How did it get worked out? Because Sierra Nevada is still involved, right?
Yeah, I think so. They had a meeting like a while back. I think it was a week and a half ago or last week. And I haven't heard much about that meeting, but it was a meeting between Scale and Sierra Nevada and Virgin to kind of work out all these issues. And it came about 2 weeks after the announcement. So that's basically what's going on with the engine.
How do you get your information? Do you require, this is going to sound crazy, I'm not asking you to name your sources, believe me, but do you require people to leak information to you? Do they come out of the meeting and quickly send you an email or call you on the phone, or do you have a network of spies out there? I mean, I'm sure these meetings and what goes on, not just with Virgin Sierra Nevada, but across the board, are pretty confidential and secretive. How do you get that information? And Doug, I want you to just go ahead and answer it. I'm going to set the microphone down. I'm getting requests from listeners to turn my volume up from that problem I mentioned earlier in the show.
Okay.
And your cell phone is not behaving like a nice cell phone, which makes it even a little bit harder. So go ahead and answer the question, and I'll be back in a second, okay?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment at all on methods and sources and anything like that. No, I just can't.
So there's no way even generally to tell us how you get information?
No, not at all.
Too bad. I'm curious. If you have a great spy network out there, maybe you could go get information about the IRS or something for us all that we'd like to know too.
Well, it's kind of funny because there's this tone of silence that is supposedly at the airport where nobody's supposed to talk, and it works about as well as the tone of silence on the old Get Smart show. remember that.
Yeah, of course I remember that. And how could I forget Agent 99? but there's other companies out there, and I'm getting a flock of emails that I'll start asking you. But, like, do you report on Interorbital and some of the other things that go on and at that amateur site that's not too far away where I know, what's his name from Long Beach, my friend, John Garvey.
Yeah, Garvey.
Yeah, and Steve Harrington from San Diego. Do you report on all that, too?
Yeah, occasionally I'll go out to FAR, and for those who don't know, FAR is called Friends of Amateur Rocketry, and it's a launch site out on the far side of Tone Lake, which is a giant lake, dry lake bed, about, I don't know, about 20 miles north of Mojave. So they do a lot of amateur testing there. They do engine tests. John Garvey did a launch, included four CubeSats that they were testing for eventual launch into orbit. You know, they did that last year, and they wrote a story on that. And there's other companies here. As we talked about Stratolaunch, as we talked about, there's not a whole lot of information coming out of there. I know Mastin's been busy with some low-level flight tests in recent months, and I've seen them out there with one of their vehicles up on a crane behind their building. X-Corps moving along toward hopefully what some initial test flights of the first Lynx. They're hoping to get that in this year. There's still parts and components coming into the shop. They've got the cockpit. They've got the fuselage in there, and they're moving toward mating those two elements of it, and they've got strakes in. And so once they get the fuselage and the cockpit together, then they can start outfitting the cockpit. And yeah, I've seen the actual instrument panel is in. So they're moving slowly, and they're also doing some additional engine tests to try to get everything straightened out on the back of the vehicle. So it's steady work. I mean, they've been working very steadily on it. They're hoping to fly probably a year and a half ago or so, but they were extremely optimistic on what it would take to fabricate and get all this stuff together. So, and Interorbital, I was kind of annoyed at them because I was one of the few weekends I was out of town back at the end of March. I went up to Death Valley for, I think, 3 days or 2.5 days, and they did an actual launch test out at FAR. And it's like, they must have known I was leaving. So it just...
And it actually worked, didn't it?
Yeah, it worked. I think they got about half the altitude that they wanted to. But, it's just... They're also a group that kind of... They move pretty slowly, and, you know, occasionally they'll do an engine test or, you know, a launch test like they did a couple months ago, and it'll be like, okay, yeah.
Are you up for... hard questions from listeners that are angry with you?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to bring it on, okay?
Sure.
Bill from Virginia, they're probably sending an email because they're angry. But anyway, Bill from Virginia, you have said that you feel there is no conflict of interest in covering Virgin while writing your book on X-Corps. Can you see how some of us say there is at least a perception of a conflict in that you have a possible financial interest in X-Corps' success because your book will do better if they are a successful company? Can you see how there might be a perception of a conflict in that you investigate and publish negative developments about Virgin Galactic, but you are restricted in publishing negative news on X-Corps because of your NDA you have with the company and writing the history of the company? Essentially, that is treating the two competitors unequally. Would you please comment?
First, let's see. I need to explain the NDA with the with X-Corps. Let me go through that. First, it's a book about X-Corps. It's not a book for X-Corps. So they have the right to review what I write about them. and they have the right to request that things be taken out if it's proprietary or if it's libelous. You know, they're protecting their rights there.
Uh-huh.
But I have a fairly free hand in being able to write about that. Now, for now, it's very difficult to. It limits my ability right now, but it gives me a free hand down the road where I can write a book and kind of explain what's going on. As for Virgin Galactic, if things were going well there, if they weren't changing engines at the last minute, if, you know, they were actually giving... They were actually, you know, giving candid answers when you asked them questions and not doing what they were doing, I'd be writing really positive stories about them. So this is... It's a difficult thing to cover Virgin Galactic because they're all PR all of the time. And, you know, the what Branson says and sometimes what comes out of others at Virgin is often at odds with any reality that's going on here in Mojave. And I find that very frustrating to cover. And I can't just sit there and run press releases saying all is well and they're going to be launching by last Christmas and all those things. So
let me take it one little step further. So despite your relationship with X-Corps, which Bill from Virginia points out, and which you, by the way, have mentioned on almost every space show you've talked about, although you don't talk about the relationship because we understand that that's confidential for now, but the listeners know you're doing that. So your reporting on Virgin, from your perspective and what you believe, is totally factual and objective based upon what you see and through whatever means you gather information for your reporting. Is that a fair assessment from your perspective?
Yeah, I try to be fair, but I also try to be, you know, honest about what they're doing and what's happening.
Any chance that you could be jaded in, I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, that you could be jaded in your conclusions and your analysis?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, to some level, but it's a tough thing to cover.
What about other journalists and bloggers? I'm sure Mojave is just inundated with people wanting to find out what's going on with the new space companies and all of that. Do you ever go out there to the what's the name of that little cafe or other places out there and you compare notes and see what they're reporting and that type of thing?
I'm basically on my own out here. I mean, there's other local reporters that cover Mojave for local publications like the Antelope Valley Press, but I'm the only one doing, you know, real hard investigative pieces into this.
Were you at ISDC this year in Los Angeles?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so I have another hard-ass question for you from another listener who's angry, I guess. This is from Joe in San Diego, and he says, I'm a Virgin fan and have been all along. If I had the money, I would certainly be buying a ticket on Virgin. In fact, I would have wanted to be one of the earlier ones to buy a ticket. But X-Corps has actually been a company that's been around much longer than Virgin. I believe X-Corps was founded around the late 1990s, maybe 1999 or so. Virgin was founded in 2004. You have reported that in 2009, X-Corps was hoping to start their test flights by the end of 2010. They have since announced their plans for test flights in 2011, 2012, 2013, and 2014 with no flights of Lynx at all. And then at this year's ISDC, were you there? X-Corps' chief pilot said they are now planning to start flying commercially in 2015 or 2016. You're critical to the nth degree of Virgin's schedule slips, of which there are many. However, wouldn't it be fair to make similar criticisms of X-Corps' schedule slips? By the way, SpaceX also has schedule slips. They have one going on right now with their next launch, though the range causes some of the problems. The satellite company causes some of the problems, and some of the problems can be attributed to issues with the Falcon 9 rocket that had to be resolved. So, in fact, everyone is going through some sort of schedule slip. It seems to me that you're heavy-handed on Virgin and not on the others.
Yeah.
Boy, you're getting hit tonight, aren't you?
Yeah.
But your cell phone is really acting up. Can you move it around? Maybe you can get to better reception.
Yeah. Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Well, it's not just slips that are the problem. I mean, everybody goes through schedule issues and slippages, but the problem with Virgin is that it's you can never get clear answers as to why. You know, if you go to a Jeff Grayson talk, and I went to the Space Access Conference last year, which was in Phoenix. This was last April. And Jeff Grayson came in and gave a talk and said, you know, this is where we are. This is what we're hoping to do. This is roughly what we're hoping in terms of the schedule. And these are the issues you know, we're dealing with. And from what I knew from following X-Corps, that was pretty much where they were. You can get straight answers out of X-Corps, and you can say, hey, you know, this is taking longer than we thought, and, you know, this is the issue here, and that's what we're dealing with. With Virgin, you can never get that. You know, you can never get a sense of where they actually are. You can never really get straight answers. You can't, you know, it's just such a PR operation and a marketing and a branding thing. And let me give you an example of what happened in the last year. So a couple weeks after that conference last year in Phoenix, Branson was here in Mojave, and they did the first powered flight with the rubber nitrous oxide engine. So they went up, they got to, I believe, 69,000 feet. They got 16 seconds of burn out of it. It was great. Branson was thrilled. And afterwards, he immediately raised prices from 200,000 to 250,000 and said, hey, you know, we're raising prices 25%. And I expect to be in space, hoping to be in space by Christmas. Now, there's absolutely no way that could be true. The engine they were flying with could not be fired for more than 20 seconds or so. It couldn't be fired for more than 20 seconds or so because the oscillations and vibrations would build up. If they double that amount to, say, 40 seconds, the ship would have started breaking up. It was that bad with the engine. So, you know, I don't know what he knew or when he knew it. I really don't care. But he, you know, he's running around saying that this was, they figured out the engine and go to space or expect to be in space by the end of the year. Couldn't do it. A few days before the 9th anniversary of him announcing Virgin Galactic and, you know, Spaceship Two, this is right around the time that the XPRIZE was done, he brought 300 customers to Mojave and told them that spaceflight was months away. This was actually, they'd done the second test a few weeks earlier, and gone to 20 seconds, and that was as far as they were going to go. They did a third test the beginning of January this year, also 20 seconds to show progress. So all of last year was simply to show progress, and they didn't have an engine that would work. And he was saying all these things. That goes beyond a slip. It goes beyond just saying, hey, it goes beyond being optimistic about the schedule. And that's the sort of stuff that I've been dealing with for years now with Virgin. They didn't have an engine 5 years ago, and they were predicting flights the next year. not a function of them having money. It's not a function of them just being optimistic on schedule, underestimating what it's going to take to do things.
Here's what I don't get, and I say this not just about Virgin, but I hear not the identical thing you're reporting, but I hear a lot of stuff, as you can imagine, through the space show about a lot of companies. And I know people who are at Virgin from the top down to employees, and they listen to the show. And I know they're dedicated. I know they're working their asses off to accomplish, their vehicles to fly for tourism and science missions. I go to most of the conferences that you go to. I mean, you know, we hang out with a lot of the same people. And, you know, it's hard for me to comprehend. By the way, I have to say I have never met Sir Richard Branson or talked to him. I'd probably recognize him, maybe, if I saw him. I'm not good at recognizing movie stars and people. My friends always say, look, there's such and such, and I say, where? I don't see him. And then I say, oh, really, that's who that is? And so I'm not really great at recognizing people by their looks. So I'm assuming I could recognize Richard Branson if I saw him and he wasn't too far away. But I know the people at Virgin and some people at Scaled, that they're really committed people with integrity. So they wouldn't do this bullshit that you're talking about. So where is, there has to be a gap someplace for this to exist. I know these people are highly committed, totally serious. You know them too. And they don't want to, you know, put bogus information out there and mislead people any more than the people at SpaceX do or X-Corp or any other company. So where is the gap? Is it with what Branson does for PR? Because he is flamboyant and a show guy. Is that the issue, or how do you see this? Because I just think the people are really dedicated and don't work like that.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question to ask. I can't.
Well, who is them? Who is them? You mean ask Sir Richard? I mean, who do you ask?
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of things are controlled out of London. You know, and I got into it about a month ago, I guess, with one of their astronaut relations people.
Yeah, you published that open letter. I saw that, and I got tons of email because it mentioned your appearance on the space show.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, who haven't seen it, I got some, they have a private Facebook page called Spacebook on Facebook for their astronauts. And after I had appeared, it was the last space show, somebody asked seven yes or no questions, or five or seven, I think it was five yes or no questions. And one of their astronaut relations people wrote back and completely trashed my reporting and said I had it out for Virgin and I was wrong about these things. So I get kind of fed up with that, and I get fed up because A, they were lying about me, and B, they were misleading their own customers. So I published an open letter to her in which I explained why I was right about all these things. So part of it's, you know, frustration. Part of my jading, if you asked me earlier if I was jaded, part of it is dealing with that, you know.
I want to move on, and I don't want to make the whole show about reporting on Virgin, and if we need to come back to it, we will. But Tony is in Seattle, and he's changing the tone here. Do you think that, and by the way, you have a caller on hold, which I'll do after Tony's email. Do you think that suborbital tourism is going to survive long term if SpaceX gets all its stages reusable?
Suborbital, I think those are different markets. I mean, SpaceX's plan is to reuse those stages to send things into orbit and be able to do that at, you know, $5 or $7 million a launch. Suborbital is a couple of things. One, it's tourism, and also there's a growing market for experiments. So I think the guys that are going to be successful in suborbital will be able to fly their vehicle, you know, very often at very low cost, be able to tap into the tourism market, but also be configured to fly experiments for researchers. And I know that X-Corps and Virgin Galactic have different paths after getting suborbital. X-Corps wants to use the Lynx as the basis for fully reusable, affordable transport to orbit, which would be multi-stages. All the stages were usable. And Virgin is looking at point-to-point suborbital New York to Tokyo in an hour or two, get a market, and they think that Spaceship Two will be kind of a good starting point for that, for, you know, Spaceship Three and Spaceship Four. And they also have some orbital ambitions. They want to, you know, they want to, you know, lease Bigelow habitats for hotels and maybe fly them up on the Dream Chaser by SNC. So that's how they're looking at it.
The caller hung up, so caller, please, if you're calling for the show, please do call back and just be patient, and we'll get to you as soon as possible. I noticed an email that came in about an hour or hour and a half before the show on one of my news services that said it looks like Congress was going to allocate $200 million to create a new ULA engine. What do you have to say about this? Do you think that's really going to happen? And that's just a drop in a bucket, obviously.
Yeah, well, there's interesting breaking news this evening about that. ULA said it had signed multiple contracts with unidentified vendors to produce a next-generation biprop, liquid fuel rocket for the Atlas.
So I don't understand this. If you know, they want Atlas and Delta because they want to have two rockets. I understand that totally, you know, for redundancy. Okay, so, you know, Atlas, which is a great rocket, depending on Russia for that, it's not turning out so well. If they build a new engine, it's going to cost upwards into billions and take many, many years. And then it's a new rocket, and you have to go through testing and developing the track record all over again, and it's not the same Atlas that has this great, fabulous track record. In the meantime, you have SpaceX, which is near Air Force certification and would likely certainly be certified long before a new engine was built, and they still have two rockets. They have the Delta, and they have, you know, the Falcon rocket. So why the hell put sparse money into creating a new version of the Atlas? We still have two competing rockets, so we still have redundancy. I don't get it.
Well, I mean, there's uncertainties about the RD-180, whether or not Russia will continue to sell those to us. Sorry. With the RD-180, Dmitry Rogozin had come out and said, we're cutting off your supply of that. However, what the Air Force and ULA has been saying is that they're still getting business as usual signals from their Russian supplier. So it's possible that they'll continue to get one RD-180 engines until they can build a replacement engine.
But then we'll have three rockets, and nobody has any money for anything space-related. You know that as well as everyone listening to this show. You know, just saw the new report come out for Pathways for going to Mars, and they're all bitching about no budgets for what it would take to go to Mars, whether you think their government program is extravagant or not. I'm not addressing that right now. And then we're going to go and build another engine, so then we have three rockets.
Yeah, well, they think they can continue to compete with the Atlas. As you know, the Delta IV is a heavy lift,
right,
and pretty expensive. Now, we'll see what the Delta IV exists if, you know, what happens with the Delta IV if SpaceX gets its Falcon Heavy going. And, you know, they're years behind schedule on the Falcon Heavy.
Yeah, they slipped, too. That's what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, they've slipped 2.5 years. 2.5 years now. I mean, it's I just looked at a press release from 2011, and they said, we'll have a Falcon Heavy at Vandenberg by the end of 2012.
Yeah, the rhetoric flies in this industry, doesn't it?
Yeah.
This is why I admire Bezos and some of the others like Stratolaunch that are really tight-chested with information, and they don't blow out press releases and crap all the time. As much as I said, I'd like to be interviewing him and getting the information, I really appreciate they're keeping everything tight and close to the chest, and to me it gives them a lot more credibility.
Yeah. So the Falcon Heavy, now looking at middle to late next year. Yeah, so...
And I'll bet you that slips again.
Yeah. So it's, Musk is... Everybody slips. It's just... You get kind of frustrated with Musk because he's sitting saying, hey, Air Force, give me the right to bid on all these things, and he still doesn't have a regular launch cadence yet. He's still years behind, he's significantly behind schedule on launching the payloads he already has, so.
It kind of runs with the industry, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You have a caller on hold. Let's see if they're still with us. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug. Welcome.
Oh, hey, Doug.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Hey, I appreciate your work. I wanted to ask a sort of follow-up on that suborbital you mentioned about the experiments. Do you think that there is a large and ongoing market for experimental rides on suborbitals?
Yeah, I do. The companies think here. I know that X-Core is pretty excited about that, and it's a market they probably didn't see coming to the extent that it probably exists. Or I don't know if I said that properly. They didn't expect that to be as potentially a large part of their business as they thought initially.
Why do you think it will be large and ongoing?
I think there's a lot of potential there for microgravity experiments. There's a lot of potential for STEM education. There's a lot of potential for testing out technologies before you launch them into space. If X-Core gets their launch cadence to the point where they can launch every day or multiple times a day, and they can do it as cheaply as they think they can, then the cost of a sending an experiment into space becomes what you can raise in a bake sale or perhaps a couple of bake sales.
Right. So I could imagine STEM, but that's not really a revenue generation for the makers of the satellites. But, there will be students forever, I suppose. So...
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Oh, I said, since there will be students forever, I think there will always be a STEM demand.
Yeah, there will be a student demand. There will be a demand by, university researchers, business researchers. I think there's a lot of potential things you can do there. And the costs have come down, if X-Core succeeds, it'll be a pretty low-cost thing.
But X-Core doesn't go to space, so how... Is that hindered versus a suborbital flight that actually goes to space?
Well, the Lynx Mark 1, I think, will go to, 39 miles. Don't quote me on that. And then the Lynx Mark 2 will go suborbital. So you have several minutes of microgravity time.
With the Mark 2, but not the Mark 1.
Not the Mark 1, but...
I have a question for you, Doug, but you're both Doug, so maybe this is a question for both Dougs. And it's not meant to address any one company. It's one of my pet peeves on the space show, and Doug, the caller, hears this pet peeve from me almost on a daily basis. He's probably sick of hearing it. How can anyone rely on the cost estimates and the projections that the companies and the space advocates and the space enthusiasts and the promoters all say are going to be out there and lower the cost and lower the prices and revolutionize everything, when none of these vehicles can fly none of them have a real test flight that's even close to operational status. None of them know the operating parameters or the windows other than what they get on their computer analysis, and that's a far cry from reality. How is any of this cost projection information reliable?
That's a great question.
I know, and none of the none of the Kool-Aid drinkers out there want to address it. They dismiss me.
We'll have to see once they start flying.
Thank you.
Can I suggest an alternate answer?
Yeah, of course.
If you buy a ticket for $250,000 from Virgin Galactic and they don't follow through with their contract, you can take them to court.
I'm not talking about the price for flying on the space tourism thing. I should have been clear on this. I'm talking about they're going to fly four times a day. They're going to do this or that, or you know, they're going to be able to fly your experiments at the cost of a couple of bake sales. That kind of statement. Yes, I know Virgin will honor the contracts that they've made or find a way to amiably, you know, renegotiate them if they have to do so. The same thing with X-Cor. I'm not concerned about that. I'm talking about all the projections that come out about how cheap Falcon Heavy is going to be, how cheap this is going to be, how this is going to revolutionize this. And none of these things are even close to doing a full scale-up operational test flight. How the hell do you know what it's going to cost?
Can I answer about Falcon Heavy?
Yeah, because you're a big believer in that. Yeah, of course.
If any of us had $135 million, we could purchase a Falcon Heavy flight. There's already one on the manifest. And if SpaceX doesn't hold up its side of the contract, you can take them to court and sue them.
Yeah, but what you're misunderstanding is that could be a loss leader flight in order to prove up the confidence, trust, and all of that. That may have absolutely nothing to do, and you don't know the answer to that, and neither do I. It could have nothing to do with the real operating parameters of what it might cost to operate and sell that rocket.
If it's a loss leader, let's take him up on it.
Well, yeah, you can, but that's not what I'm asking about. How can you or anyone project all these fabulous cost benefits coming out of all these different companies? And again, I'm not directing it to SpaceX or Virgin or X-Corp or any, it's across the board, and it's also addressed to the people who are the true believers in all of this. How can we rely on the cost estimates that everyone is projecting and throwing out there? And Doug, of Parabolic Arc, you just said they hope to get costs down to the level of several bake sales. How can you do that when you have no information?
Cost for a single experiment.
Yeah, but we don't know what the flight rate is going to be or anything.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean I don't know. I mean you just have to wait and see and watch them perform and see if they can do what they say they can do.
And I just caution people to not jump on the bandwagon of all of this projection stuff that's not based on reality yet. Wait till you see the projections after they come out with operating test flights, and then you start to have real information and flight rates and what the problems are that they encounter and, you know, delays and all of this kind of stuff. Then you start to come up with real information that can help you understand real pricing, you know, coming up and what the restraints might be or what the caveats might be.
Yeah. The other thing I'd mention in terms of experiments is the NASA Flight Opportunities Program. So NASA's been putting money into, you know, spurring on that market, and they haven't been able to fly, obviously, on Spaceship Two or Lynx, but they've been flying on a number of other vehicles. And in fact, just announced their payloads they selected for the first Virgin Galactic research flight. That was done a week or two ago, I think. Doug, I have another question.
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-huh.
You mentioned about Maston and seeing some activity there. Are you aware of the damaged Centaur stage that ULA donated to Maston?
That's a Centaur upper stage?
Yeah, it's an old stage that was damaged, a sliding door on a warehouse or a hangar.
It's sitting in a building here in Mojave, and I'm not sure what the schedule is for trying to put engines on it. For those who don't know, Mastin wants to be able to demonstrate that they could land a Centaur upper stage on the moon, and they want to do some tests in Mojave to kind of demonstrate they can do that. And you know, they could be a fuel depot for future, you know, future human exploration.
Well, I think they're looking first at the lander. It's a reusable lander, but that technology. I think, yeah, ULA has written up about how the Centaur upper stage can be shielded from the heat of the sun and used as a cryogenic propellant depot.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the Centaur. Centaur is the upper stage for Atlas V and also the Delta IV. And basically, they're trying to re-engineer that. X-Core is working on an advanced engine that would replace the RL-10. It's supposed to have similar performance, but cost a lot less. The value of that is also that it would be reusable. So you could send a Centaur with fuel, use it as a space tug, use it as potentially a fuel depot in space. There'd be a lot of uses for that.
Are you familiar with the ACES architecture?
What's that?
Are you familiar with the ULA ACES architecture?
I'm not entirely, no, probably.
It's their concept, ULA's concept for using the Centaur in three different versions for missions to the moon.
Right. I think what I was just describing is part of that.
Okay.
Part of that. They basically re-engineer the Centaur to have a number of different uses in cislunar space, and that would involve a new engine. And the new engine's pretty crucial to getting the cost of both the Delta IV and the Atlas V down considerably. It'd be a lot cheaper to use, to build and operate. That's the intention.
And I understand the RL-10 is pretty expensive and difficult to produce.
I don't know if it's difficult to produce, but it's pretty expensive.
Okay.
So.
All right. My final question, Doug, is seems like I read recently, I think previously I read that the Falcon Heavy the first one is going to launch from Vandenberg, but now I'm hearing maybe it will be from Cape Canaveral. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I mean, the original plan was to get a Falcon Heavy to Vandenberg by the end of 2012 and launch it sometime in the first half of 2013. They made an announcement a couple months ago that they were going to shift that to Kennedy. Not sure exactly why, but I think it would go from Launch Pad 39A, which is the old shuttle launch pad. And,
haven't they built a launch pad for Falcon Heavy at Vandenberg?
Yeah, they were building it, so I'm not sure what status that is right now.
I'm personally terribly disappointed because I wanted to go and launch that.
Yeah, it'd be a hell of a thing to watch.
Yeah,
from the hobby, actually, probably.
Why don't you just watch the simulation on PowerPoint, Doug, and get your trills that way? Well, there is no real thing. Come on. Maybe someday there will be, but there is no real thing.
David, we've been through this so many times. I mean,
you're incorrigible.
It's on 9 times. That's real. Falcon Heavy is 3 Falcon 9s largely together.
You have a question from Tony in Seattle, and I just told him I'm going to rename the show called the Disneyland Space Show Radio Program because I'm rapidly reaching my threshold of all of this stuff. But Doug, this is to you, the caller, not Doug, not Doug of Parabolic Arc. To Doug, the caller, do you think RP-1 can be made on the moon with solar jet technology and the Fischer-Tropsch process so that SpaceX does not have to develop a methane upper stage Flatcon 9 to make Cislunar 1 happen?
I think this is Tony.
Tony in Seattle.
Yeah. You know, I saw that information you sent, and I looked it up. I think it's possible, but I'm not beholden to SpaceX technology. I think that possibly ULA would, it seems to be showing more, much more interest in going to the moon and in using the Centaur. So I think that there's a chemical process, I forget the name of it, that could, where you could produce methane from the carbon monoxide in the ice and use it for a methane engine, which I think has higher performance. So that's the direction I'm leaning right now.
Okay, and as I change the name to the Disneyland of Space, if I don't get sued for doing it, I wonder if I can start a Mickey Mouse Club, Space Advocate Club, to support the new space show name. What do you guys think? That, and you'll all go to stardom, because look at all the Mouseketeers that rise up and become famous and multimillionaires and everything. So this will be a pathway to great success to be part of the Space Show Mickey Mouse Club. What do you think?
See how much we're helping you, David.
That's right. You've given me the greatest business idea of 2014. I love it.
All right.
Just, I need a lawyer out there to tell me how to avoid copyright and trademark issues.
All right.
Thank you, Doug, for your call.
Yep. Appreciate it.
Okay. Oh. And Doug of Parabolic Arc, we're behind the eight ball, so we're going to take our pause and our break right now. And
okay.
We will come back with more of your questions. And listeners, the phone line is clear, 1-866-687-7223. Don't go anywhere. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the part two of the Space Show, which is a special edition program, Monday evening rather than Monday afternoon. Our guest today is Doug Messier, and he is the managing editor of ParabolicArc.com. And we're talking about all sorts of things going on. And in this final segment, Doug, I see they're going to allocate, or they're thinking of allocating, an additional $400 million to NASA. Do you see that happening, and do you have any idea how it would be used?
Yeah, that's a good question. The president came in, the House and the Senate have gone through initial budget for NASA for FY 2015, which starts on October 1st, and they've both given the proposed budget about a $400 million boost. So the Senate comes in at $17.9 billion, and I think the House is at $17.896. So very close. Most of the spending priorities are pretty closely aligned from the two houses. Normally, it's the administration that wants to spend more money on NASA, and Congress often wants to cut it. So it's a good sign that Congress seems to have come through so far with a higher budget.
What do you think attributes a higher budget?
I think the end of fiscal restraints. You know, you were under limitations last year and the last few years. To cut the budget, and with the budget deal that was worked out after the closing of the government last year, it seemed to have lifted some of the spending constraints. And there's like $2.9 billion for SLS and Orion, which is the deep space and heavy lift vehicle, the deep space launcher, and a heavy lift launcher and a deep space capsule, rather. And then they got pretty close. The Senate got pretty close in terms of commercial crew. I think the administration asked for 843 million, and the Senate is at, or 848 million, and then the Senate's at 805, and then I think the House is at 785. So that's it's close. It's not everything the administration wanted. So we'll see if those programs stay on track for flying by the end of 2017, flying crews to the station. Elon Musk thinks he can do it a year earlier. Given the way his schedule tends to slip, I'm skeptical of that. But so there's, yeah, and there were some boosts to the science budget, and I think the House wanted to spend $100 million on Europa mission, and the Senate didn't give any money for that, but it kind of mandated that NASA look into using the heavy lift vehicle for that, the Space Launch System. Now, the concerns with commercial crew, the House wants NASA to select one vendor and fund that to completion, and they think the $785 million they're providing in FY 2015 won't be sufficient to do that. That the Senate is putting out some provisions that the whoever's chosen provide very detailed cost estimates, and the commercial, and there's big fear that that's a poison pill that Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama has put into the legislation to try to make the program overly expensive and sort of conforming with traditional NASA contracting. So the Space Access Society is opposed to that. And they've urged people to call their senators about it. And also the Space Frontier Foundation came out with a statement urging the same thing at the end of last week. So,
but it's the language is still there, right?
Yeah, the language is still there. It's only in the Senate bill. And I think the Senate bill came out of Commerce, Justice, and Science Committee. I'm not sure I think it might have been approved by the full Senate Appropriations Committee. So they're trying to get that removed from the Senate measure. And then, you know, as the two different bills from the House and the Senate go to reconciliation where they iron out the differences, so there's an opportunity there potentially to get that removed.
You think it should be removed? What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it just burdens the program with a lot of extra costs, and it's supposedly about accountability and transparency, but something that Henry Vanderbilt at Space Access Society pointed out in one of his action alerts is that if Richard Shelby was really worried about transparency and accurate cost estimates, he's got much bigger problems on the Space Launch System.
On
the Space Launch System is being built and designed in Huntsville, so you know, he doesn't seem to care about accountability on that.
On your blog from earlier today, you have a picture of what looks like a totally cool UFO on it, and you say decelerator flight test postponed due to high winds. What is the decelerator? Tell us about that. And that picture absolutely looks like a sci-fi UFO.
Yeah, it's a new way of being able to land. Kind of a new way of being able to land larger payloads on Mars. So it would be able to decelerate through the atmosphere. And remember that crazy sky crane they used with Curiosity 2 years ago? And, you know, it's a Rube Goldberg thing that actually worked. But this thing would allow larger payloads, and they want to test it off of Kauai, I believe, in Hawaii. But they've had adverse winds last week, so they had to cancel that, and they're going to reset another date.
Do you know how it works?
that's a good question. I don't. I haven't looked at it too closely. But I think the test takes it up takes this thing up to an altitude on a balloon, and then there's a rocket underneath that accelerates it up, and then it kind of re-enters the atmosphere. So that's it's interesting. I don't cover the Mars program that closely, but it's an interesting technology.
I see you're covering potential new Ariane launchers. You've got an article about that, too, and I just had the head of Ariane Space here in America, Clay Mowry, back on the show, and he talked a little bit, but not very much, about Ariane 6.
It's a complicated thing. It's split Europe. France would like to go directly to an Ariane 6, and basically what that would be, the current Ariane 5 launches two satellites, and there's like a large satellite and a small satellite. And Ariane 6 would be a cheaper, simpler booster that would be single satellite launch. And they think that's a way of competing with SpaceX and other launchers. So they want to go directly to that and do that as fast as they can. But the Germans are interested in a Ariane 5 mid-life evolution, called the Ariane 5 ME. And basically it would be enhancements to the current Ariane 5. So they could launch larger satellites to larger satellites and also extend that through the end of probably the decade. So there's been debate within Europe about what to do, whether to use a liquid engine for Ariane 6 or to use a solid first stage. And so that's going on. And what happened today was the announcement of Airbus announced that it was teaming with Safran?
Yeah, Safran, I think.
Safran, to kind of gear up for the upgraded Ariane rockets. So that's what basically happened today.
And here's a program you're reporting on, and God, I haven't heard about this in a long time. In fact, I was thinking maybe they're long gone history, Centennial Challenges, NASA Centennial Challenges, and now they're looking at deep space and CubeSats in deep space.
Yeah,
for prizes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of a mind blower, too.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. And NASA's been doing a lot of, NASA's been focusing on how to get CubeSats into deep space. So the SBIR program, which gives grants to small businesses, they had a specific area in which they focused on CubeSats, and there are a number of proposals that they funded in the latest round for improving CubeSats and getting them into deep space and things like that. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what they do out there, because you can send a fleet of them to, say, go look for water on the moon. Or I actually saw a proposal, an advanced proposal last year, to use CubeSats to return a sample from Phobos. So we're working on a lot of different technologies for things like navigation, propulsion, communications, to see how capable they can make these satellites. So it's interesting to follow. They've been mostly or entirely limited to Earth orbit, so it'll be interesting to see what they can do in deep space.
You have email from Roger, who's in Las Vegas.
Okay.
And Roger says, before your show ends tonight, David asked Doug to comment on Google's proposal to buy Skybox Imaging for $500 million. Is this part of their desire to have global internet or something?
I think the Skybox part of it is they can do videos from space and also imaging. So that allows them to do better mapping and things like that. There's a separate program that they're working on through a company called Worldview, which they're backing to provide global broadband coverage. And that would involve hundreds of satellites being launched. And there's a, not to get back to Virgin Galactic and make the show about that, but there's a Virgin Galactic angle to that in the sense that there's a deal being made to use Launcher One, which is what Virgin's been developing to launch some of those satellites.
I thought they were going to sell that to Google. Didn't I read an article about that?
Yeah, one possible deal would be to sell the technology and the team to Google and have Google invest the rest of the money to develop that, because they've developed the engines, but I don't think they've gone any further than developing the Newton engines. So there is a deal about that, and that deal, I'd written about it back in May, and suddenly everybody gets chatty about it last week, the day after my appearance on The Bachelor show. So I don't know if that was coincidental or not, but it was sort of, hey, look over here, this is what we're doing. So it was interesting.
Do you have any news on, since we're talking about Google, on Lunar X Prize?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like there's some serious teams, including Moon Express, that we'll be launching next year and trying to win that prize, and we'll see if they are successful.
Are you optimistic that someone will win it?
It's probably. I mean, Moon Express is a potential winner, and also Astrobotic. I think both of those are well organized in terms of the technical side and know what they're doing on that. And I know that Moon Express has a fair amount of money behind it. So, you know, it could be another one of these things where a very rich man, a billionaire, a millionaire, puts enough money into something to make it work.
Carl in Tucson, Arizona, by email. And, guys, come on, you're no one's at work, so why don't you pick up the phone and use the phone instead of email? 1-866-687-7223, or I should say most of you are not at work. Anyway, Carl says, I follow Parabolic Arc every day, and I found very interesting your pictures of and information about the new Russian launch vehicle, Angara, scheduled to launch next week. Do you have any additional insights on that? What vehicle, what launcher is that intending to replace? Do you think it will be immune from problems, unlike Proton?
Well, I think Proton, Angara has been in development for 19 years now. Started in 1995, and they're finally getting to launch it. It's intended to replace a whole bunch of things. Proton is one. Also, some of the smaller vehicles like Dnieper and Rockot, and also I think the Zenit. Part of it is an effort to get away from anything, you know, being dependent on Ukraine for some of these rockets. And so there's three main variants. There's the Angara 1, Angara 5, Angara 7, and I think that goes from about 3.7 metric tons to maybe 35 metric tons. So it's a modular series. There's a core, upper stages, and they can add strap-on boosters. A couple of issues with that. One, I mean, this technology has been in development for 19 years, so is it necessarily state-of-the-art? Two, Khrunichev has had serious, serious problems with quality control. It's lost another Proton rocket recently. Due to an upper stage anomaly. And three, can they make that affordable to be competitive, you know, to be an affordable thing? And a lot of these things will be for military launches. So is the military being burdened with a very expensive launcher with no history when they can use other launch vehicles that are already in development and already have a flight history. So,
is that June 25th launch pretty fixed and firm, or do you expect a slip?
I don't know. It seems pretty firm. You can always slip. I'm understanding it's a suborbital launch. We'll test the first and second stages, and probably they don't have a payload for it or an upper stage to put it into anything into orbit. And I think, you know, they probably don't need to test the upper stage because it's probably, it might be something that they've used before. Yeah.
So speaking about launches coming up, what do you hear about the Orbcomm SpaceX launch? That seems to be back on hold again, right?
It's Friday night. The latest thing I heard was Friday the 25th from the Cape. So we'll
Friday's not the Wednesday's the 25th. So Friday's the 20th.
Oh, the 20th, yes, you're right, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's the 20th, Friday the 20th. And they did a static test, I think, on Saturday, so the rocket seems like it's in good shape to fly. They had a helium leak before.
So you think it'll go?
Yeah, I hope so.
I certainly hope so, too. Of all the stories and things that you're covering, what turns you on the most? What's the most interesting to you?
Dang, that's a good question. The Virgin thing's been certainly the most interesting development. It can be interesting to see them start flying later this year, probably late summer, and see if they can get Branson up. As they want to by the end of the year. I think that's a very tight schedule. It's interesting to watch export, you know, go on. It's slow progress, you know, slow, gradual, everyday progress, so it's nothing dramatic there. And it's interesting to watch, you know, Elon and his fight against the Air Force, so...
Yeah, how do you think that's going to turn out?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't like predicting legally things. I've said this on my site. I think the Air Force had a better case than Elon believes, obviously, and a lot of people think for giving a bulk buy to the ULA. And I wish Elon would spend more time launching than... suing and doing other things, you know.
Did you go to his Dragon version 2 unveiling?
Oh, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
What did you think? Did you go inside the Dragon?
Oh, yeah.
What did you think of it? Give us your impressions.
Yeah, it was a really cool spacecraft. I think it's missing a lot of stuff that it needs.
Yeah, it was pretty stripped down, I understand.
Yeah, externally, so it was great to see that how he presents that stuff because it's much more, you know, he's much more savvy on presentation and PR than the more established aerospace company like Boeing. So, it's a big spectacle. And
did you sit in one of the chairs inside the Dragon?
I did not. I did not. There's a line of people behind me, so spent a lot of time in there. I got some good pictures.
Did you listen to the hour-long press conference or Q&A he had after the unveiling ceremony?
Yeah, I did, or at least I tried. And initially, he didn't have a microphone, so there was a big crowd around him, and unless you were, you know, right there, it was hard to hear him. But someone actually recorded the whole thing and posted it on YouTube, so I was able to listen to that later.
Yeah, there's also a guy who does Elon Musk transcripts. You're probably familiar with it too.
Yeah,
and has a website, and I'll give it out again, listeners, but don't attack me for the name. I had nothing to do with it. I know who's behind it now, and I know why he chose that name. But if you want to read the transcript, which is 8 pages and goes a lot faster than listening to really crummy audio on the YouTube video for 50 minutes. The name of the website is Shit Elon says. I'm not kidding you. So that the I'm not kidding you is my addition. That's not part of the URL. So they list a lot of public talks that Elon has said, and they go from the top is the oldest, and the newest is down at the bottom. So you have to scroll through the list. And you can find it on that website, and he does recordings and transcripts and puts them up on this blog on his own. He's not officially connected to SpaceX or Elon or anything like that. So, again, if you want to read that press conference rather than try to go through the hour-long YouTube video, that's what you need to do. And, you know, it might turn out to be a good resource for people who want to read Elon Musk transcripts. I don't know what to say. You've probably reported it on your blog, and I missed it.
No, I didn't. I had the video up on the blog.
Yeah, I saw the video. I got the transcript blog from Charles Lurio. So.
And it's, you know, I mean, Elon's good because he often doesn't have much of a filter, so you can ask him stuff and get interesting answers that are not necessarily maybe what he should be saying, but definitely makes good copy.
Anything you're working on that's coming up that we should be aware of or start looking for?
Well, it's the 10th anniversary of the first Spaceship One flight to space on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
So that's really kind of a cool anniversary. Mike Melville will be talking at the monthly Plane Crazy event at the airport at 11 o'clock.
At Mojave, right?
Yeah, in Mojave, and I'm planning to hopefully record that and do a story either, hopefully for my blog, definitely for my blog, and possibly for another publication. So that should be an interesting talk to hear his reminiscences about that. And I may also do some analysis on, you know, where are we right now? It's 10 years later, and we're still not, you know, there hasn't been, there were two flights into space in September and October of that year, and to win the X Prize, and then nothing since then, so.
Well, I think it's much harder than people thought or think.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. The other thing is that I think the X Prize led Burt Rutan into areas and down alleys he probably wouldn't have gone down. And it makes me kind of skeptical about the prize and whether the unintended consequences of a prize directing people to develop technologies toward a particular goal when they might have gone in different directions. So there's all sorts of interesting issues around that.
Well, you can't roll the clock back, Doug.
No, you can't, but you can learn for the future.
Learn for the future.
Yeah.
Any closing comments? We need to do an on-time ending because I got to get this archived early in the morning, and then I have a whole day of appointments not related to space tomorrow. Closing comments, pearls of wisdom, takeaways, what you want us to know about or forget about?
Nothing I can think of. Just go USA. Be done it today, and they've got Germany and Portugal ahead of them. So.
I have one last email question that came in. You want to take it for a quick minute?
Sure.
Sally is in Phoenix, Arizona. Doug, given all of the comments you made and some of the hard questions you responded to about Virgin Galactic and the way you report about Virgin, could you please tell us point blank, clearly, succinctly, no double talk. Do you want Virgin Galactic to succeed, or do you want them to fail and only X-Corp to succeed?
I want them all to succeed. I want them all to be flying, and flying safely, and doing it, you know, doing it frequently. This is not about me. It's not about me and my actions. It's about what X-Corp is doing and what Virgin Galactic is doing. You know, I'd love to see Virgin Galactic succeed. I think a lot of people at X-Corp would love to see Virgin Galactic succeed. Because we're trying to build an industry here. We're trying to get an industry out. And if companies don't succeed, if they have accidents and go out of business, if they can't keep an operation, that's bad for the whole industry. So there's no part of me that doesn't want Virgin Galactic to succeed. There's a part of me that wished they were more candid about what they were doing. And they weren't putting out stuff that I know is not true. And I want them to be more honest about what they're doing and not put me in a position where if I run their press releases, I know they're bullshit. And sometimes they are. And X-Corps doesn't do that to that extent. They're pretty honest people.
So to be clear on that, you're not reporting on Virgin to do them in. You want them and all of these companies to be successful, and you're committed to seeing this industry develop. I'm just trying to erase any ambiguities. I'm not trying to kiss your butt or anything like that.
Absolutely.
I want to have a clear expression of your intentions and why you do what you do on this space show program, since it's been there's been a lot of hard-ass questions to you about your reporting on Virgin. So I want to give you every chance to respond and be crystal clear to listeners.
Yeah, I want Virgin to succeed and I want them to do well, but that desire to go see them succeed doesn't supersede my interest in reporting on what they're doing and reporting accurately to my readers. My commitment is to my readers to tell them the truth about what's happening.
So I kind of have a lot of empathy with you, because I started the space show and then the nonprofit 501c3 One Giant Leap as an educational organization and foundation, and our application to the IRS is about space education.
Right.
So when I'm a hard ass to the La La Land guys and the fantasy and all the inflated rhetoric and all of that stuff, and when I give Doug, the caller, a hard time, it's about education. I believe that the human spaceflight program is really dependent upon SpaceX to a large degree. And I want SpaceX to be very successful, and these guys have been wonderful with me, and I know lots of people that work there, and I know their commitment, but that doesn't mean that you can take what is not yet realistic and count it as real, and count the advocacy and enthusiast cost projections and all this nonsense as realistic. And so I wouldn't be doing my job as a teacher and having the space show serve as an educational purpose if I didn't at least call everyone on this crap. And I personally think the industry would be better served if all this fantasy la-la land Kool-Aid stuff wasn't permeating out there about every one of these companies and all of these personalities. I think it does a disservice. Although I do believe it helps get a lot of attention, and it's a lot more interesting than boring facts. I totally understand that and agree with that. But that's why I take these really hard positions on reality-based, evidentiary-based, facts and analysis as a college professor, rather than condoning all the nonsense that goes out there in the fantasy.
And, yeah, absolutely right.
And that you're kind of similar to your position in a way.
Yeah, definitely. And let me add something else that people don't consider. There's been a lot of money invested in this company. The Abu Dhabi government, through ABAR Investments, has put in $390 million. That's most of the money that's been invested in this. The taxpayers in New Mexico are on the hook for $218 million. And the longer the delays go, the bigger that rises, the bigger that increases. It'll probably be up to a $250 million. Custom-built spaceport in the middle of nowhere. There are 700 people that have signed up for tickets based on what Virgin Galactic tells them about safety, about what they're going to be able to do, what they're going to be able to provide for them. And then there's the readers that, those people are constituents that I'm trying to write for. I'm trying to keep them informed about what's going on with this company, what they're doing, what they're not doing, what they're succeeding at, what they're not succeeding at. And I know some of these people have tickets. They're friends of mine. And, you know, I want them going into this with their eyes open. So I serve those people. And it's not a matter of me wanting, I mean, I want this company to succeed. I want Extercore to succeed, Blue Origin, all these guys. It's not a personal thing where I'm disliking, you know, Virgin. And, you know, I have to tell them the truth about what's happening, to tell my readers, and I know that these people read it. And, you know, when there's big gaps between what, you know, Virgin puts out there and what's actually happening here in Mojave and what's likely to happen down the road, I can't turn away from that. I can't turn a blind eye to that.
Have you ever interviewed any of the top people from Virgin?
No, I don't. I mean, I think I have for a couple of stories, but...
No, I mean, like, sit down, like I do a space show program, sit down for a print interview for 30 minutes with some top people at Virgin and go through some of these issues and more and present a fact-based, hard-hitting interview. And I'm sure the Virgin guys would probably interview you at the same time. As to why you do this, that, or the other. And I think your readers and Virgin people and ticket holders and all that would be really well served if Virgin and you are both going to be at New Space in Silicon Valley coming up next month. Maybe you can arrange a 30-minute sit-down and do a hard-hitting two-way interview. I think your readers and people interested in Virgin would be very well served by that.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. I will pursue it.
Okay. And, you know, if you wanted me to join it for the space show and record it here, I'd get my 2 cents and my feet in the door. I'd put it up audibly on the space show program, and you could put it up print-wise on your blog.
Okay.
So just a thought, but I just think we'd be really served if you went head-to-head with people from Virgin, and a Virgin went head-to-head with you. I think it'd be great for all of us out here that want to know more and don't like to have the perception that there's a fight going on, because nobody wants a fight within the industry, because the industry is going to take the hits.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Doug, until the next time you're on the show, and I'll look forward to seeing you up at Silicon Valley, because I'm sure you'll be up there for New Space. And
yeah, I will, and thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Always a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you next month as well. And listeners, that's it. So tomorrow night we're talking about the New Space Conference coming up with Aaron and Sarah, and you don't want to miss that, because the New Space this year is going to be pretty cool. The lightning round, we'll talk some more about that. The winners, not the winners, the final competitors are announced for the business planned lightning round that they're doing this year, and we'll go over a little bit of that. And then Wednesday, a special program with Paul Spoudis. He's going to give us his comments on the NRC Pathways to Mars Human Spaceflight Study. And that program will archive on Friday, because I'm going out of town, and that will be our Friday program, although it will be live Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. No show on Sunday. No show on Monday due to my personal travels. And then Tuesday, hold on to your hat, Bob Zimmerman is back. But now we're dependent upon United Airlines getting me back on time to do the show. So if United does a good job, Bob Zimmerman will return a week from tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for your emails, and Dr. Doug for calling in. And Doug, thank you again for joining us for another space show program. Good night, everybody. Bye from the space show.